You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes. Penned by Steven Spielberg and directed by Tobe Hooper, Poltergeist, released in 1982, proved that a suburban American family house can be just as scary as a gothic English manor, and that television can become a dangerous medium connecting us to otherworldly monsters. Joined by Master of Horror Mick Garris, today's episode explores the Freeling family story set in suburban Cuesta Verde, California. Carol Ann, the youngest child in the family, has a special gift and begins conversing with the television set, famously announcing, "They're here." The ghostly presence transforms the family home into a living hell, continually plagued by a series of paranormal phenomena. Little Carol Ann gets pulled into a portal inside her bedroom closet. A team of parapsychologists comes to the rescue and discovers that the Cuesta Verde housing development was built on a Native American cemetery. Covering a wide variety of themes, from the genocide of the indigenous population to the omnipresence of television in contemporary households, Poltergeist was the starting point for a successful franchise and left a lasting mark on popular culture that continues to inspire new fans today.
Mick Garris is an American filmmaker, screenwriter, and novelist. He is best known for his work in the horror film genre, as well as making Stephen King adaptations. Garris is the creator of the Showtime series Masters of Horror and the NBC series Fear Itself. He was also the co-screenwriter and executive producer of Hocus Pocus. Among other films and TV series, he directed Sleepwalkers, The Stand, and Psycho 4.
Welcome, Mick Garris, to After Images podcast. We're so delighted to have you here today to discuss Tobe Hooper's 1982 Poltergeist.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you, Franck and Marina.
Thanks. So we always like to begin with the question, what does Poltergeist mean to you? And I know in your case that you actually visited the set multiple times, so you were actually there when the film was being created. So tell us a little bit about why you suggested the film today and what it means to you all these years later.
Well, it was a groundbreaking movie. It was a ghost story that it harkens back to older films like The Haunting and the like, but it sets it in a suburban neighborhood that most of us can associate with more than a crumbling old mansion or something. And my personal connection to it was that I was hired to do specialized genre publicity for it, which was something I'd done on E.T. and The Thing and Videodrome and The Howling and things like that. So I had known Steven Spielberg. He'd been a guest on my Z Channel interview show. And I met Tobe Hooper on the set of Poltergeist. And he, it turned out, came up to me and said he was a fan of my interview show. And it's like, no, wait a minute. I'm a fan of yours. And it began a lifelong friendship. So Poltergeist feels really personal to me. And having known both men who are involved in the controversy of who made Poltergeist, I have perhaps a little bit different perspective than most people do.
Shall we jump directly into the controversy? Because before we talk about the film itself, can you tell us about your vision of how it went between Steven Spielberg and Tobe Hooper?
Sure. You know, a really great comparison is the great producer from the 1940s who did RKO movies, Val Lewton. His personal stamp was on all of his films, regardless of working with really good directors like Robert Wise and Jacques Tourneur, people like that. So here's Tobe Hooper doing his first major studio picture, hired by Steven Spielberg. Steven Spielberg, the most successful director in Hollywood history at that time, and maybe still. He brought in Tobe Hooper. Tobe Hooper was there every day on set calling action and cut. Spielberg was on set many of the days, if not most of the days, and would make suggestions. And I saw him get on the camera dolly and say, let's move in here, do a two shot. And Toby would agree to it. So my perspective is I watched Toby in pre-production give lots of himself, put a lot of himself into the movie, in production be on the set, always calling action, always calling cut, and watching Steven Spielberg collaborate with him. So in my interpretation, and I was there several times, Toby Hooper was the director working with a very strong producer who also happened to be a director. So naturally, he was going to give his input. And Toby didn't always take his input, but he usually did. It's just like if I'm directing a Stephen King project, of which I've done many, and Stephen King is on the set and has an idea, I'd be a fool not to listen to it. Now, in my case, Stephen King has never told me how I should direct a scene, but Spielberg would make those contributions. And remember as well that Spielberg wrote the shooting draft of the script. So it was a very personal project for him, but I see it as a film by Toby Hooper with a very strong, influential producer.
Thank you. And that reminds us of the extent to which film is such a collaborative art form anyway, which I think people tend to forget about when they're writing about films in the media, just how essential that is.
Well, and people forget it starts with a script. And a director guides a screenplay and helps the actors and the key crew people do their best work in interpreting that script. So it's not always the vision of a director 100%. A director can influence the shape of a film, but in a lot of cases, particularly when a director is hired to do a project that already exists, as in the case of Poltergeist, that director can do as much as he can to influence the personality of the film. But in reality, there's also a director of photography. There are also actors. There's also a production designer. There are creature effects designers. All of these people have creative input that helps to shape what the film is going to be.
And talking about the importance of the script, I read that Steven Spielberg wanted Stephen King to collaborate and co-write the script with him, but that he wasn't available at the time. Do you have more information about this?
Well, I know that that is true, that King had been asked to do a draft of the script, but wasn't able to do that. But it was originally written by Mark Victor and Michael Grace, and then they did a few drafts. And then Spielberg came in and said, I love this. Let me do my draft of it. And that's why I think he's also credited with screenplay. I'm not positive about that, but I think he is. And so you can definitely feel his touch. So as a producer, as well as a writer, he definitely had an influence over the shape of the film.
Well, let's hop right into the film itself, thinking about things like special effects, filmmaking, the script, this transposition of a great ghost story to the modern 1980s suburb development. What is it about the film that you love? Is it the kind of synthesis of all those elements, including the great sound design, or are there particular things you can pick out and tell us about that you love?
Well, I mean, there's everything about it. The cast is so well assembled. They're so great. They're so believable. They're so real. And I was brought up in the San Fernando Valley. So it's a little more upscale than the neighborhood that I was brought up in, but it was very familiar to me. I knew those people. I knew those neighborhoods where all of those houses looked alike in the development number 5 and all of those things. You know, my neighborhood was one of those World War II neighborhoods that were built up during the 40s for under the GI Bill, where there was government assistance for people who had been in the service. My father had been in the Navy. And so there were all of these veterans who were living in these cracker box houses that were all very much alike, but it was a sweet and sane neighborhood, and it felt very safe. And so to take all of these tropes, some of which are absolutely unbelievable in the truest sense, and to put them in the most natural, the most believable, the most relatable neighborhood was really powerful for me. And they weren't just ghosts, they were monsters. So it went beyond what the haunting was. It was not genteel in its presentation. You thought it was at first, and Spielberg was the king of doing family movies like E.T., which came out, well, let's see, I think E.T. was 2 weeks before Poltergeist, or vice versa, I forget. One was June 4th, and one was June 11th. So there was a week apart. But I loved monsters, and I never thought it was going to go that far. And it just goes so over the top with the swimming pool scene and the cadavers and the coffins and everything coming out of somebody's backyard swimming pool. And if you had a swimming pool in the valley in Southern California, you were doing better than most people. Well, not anymore.
Well, it's very interesting that there is this layer of normalcy that you see in that housing development. But underneath, there are all those demons, all this past that is repressed, all this haunting that is coming from the past of the nation that is not dead. And that is also something that is very close to Stephen King. I think of Pet Sematary here with the same idea of a native burial ground being underneath the colonization of the Europeans. I think we find this too in Poltergeist, don't we?
Yeah, there's a lot of national guilt in this, and especially the developers of the project, of the housing project, because they knew they were building on ancient burial grounds, and they just didn't give a damn. And they were displacing bodies or just ignoring it and building foundations right over these burial grounds. But it is very much a Stephen King movie not written by Stephen King. I don't think anybody was setting out to copy Stephen King, but certainly his influence is felt here in the best possible way. And Poltergeist is one of those movies that you can watch over and over and over again. If you happen to be spinning through the channels on your TV, and it comes up, no matter where it starts, I will watch it until it ends. You know, oh, Poltergeist is on. Let's see this. And I never get sick of it. But you know, the American guilt, that was a hangover from the 70s with Vietnam, you know, which was very had a huge impression, especially on creative people at the time. And the creative people who had the sensitivity to feel the guilt for our involvement in a war that never should have involved us. And so it's 1982. There's a little bit of a carryover from those feelings of the 70s that guided filmmakers like George Romero and like Tobe Hooper, whose Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a revolt against the Vietnam War.
I mean, this is where something I was telling Marisa before the show. I was thinking about the career of Tobe Hooper and about the fact that, to me anyway, Texas Chainsaw Massacre is almost like the requiem for the 1960s and 70s. It's the end of the flower power. It's the end of the utopia that was alive in the United States at this moment. Whereas Poltergeist feels very much like the beginning of a new era, the beginning of the Reagan era, the beginning of neoliberalism. Do you agree with this? Do you think that there might be something about that?
Yeah, I think so. And what makes it even more interesting is that Tobe Hooper was a rebel of the 70s. And Spielberg was not so much a rebel. He was more in the mainstream in his beginnings, even though he was also involved in rebellious storytelling with things like Duel and Sugar Land Express. But Tobe was very much a rebel and a hippie. Who made very aggressive movies. And here he is making a film for the giant studio system, making a movie with the man, you know? And by that, I don't mean Spielberg, I mean Hollywood. I mean, MGM at that time, which was barely a studio at that time. And it was heading for complete disarray. But he was working within the studio system and not really being allowed to be 100% the rebel that he was, and yet seeing the artistry of some of a rebellious filmmaker like Toby working within the system with union crew and with the hours that had to be done, and no, you can't plug that in, that's an electrician's job, no, you can't cross the line of doing makeups, and all of that was fascinating to watch.
I'm thinking back to this time because, as someone who was born in 1980, even though Poltergeist came out in 82, it completely haunted my childhood with the subsequent
Really?
films that came out. And I just have such strong memories of that image everywhere of little Heather O'Rourke in front of the television with her
Yeah.
hand planted against it, the back of her head with the long hair and that static on the screen.
Oh,
And
it's an iconic image, Marisa.
it is. It really is. And I also recall the kind of panic that there was surrounding television, the kind of demonizing that you would get at that moment in time regarding the television. So I was curious what you thought about the use of electronic devices in the film, and especially the role of the television.
Well, television was everybody's babysitter, especially at that time. Television was kind of at its peak. You could get millions of people would all be watching the same show as opposed to now when you just stream whatever you want whenever you want it. So there's no coffee table effect where you're around the water station at work talking about what everybody saw last night. That doesn't happen anymore. But it was communal. And in fact, the opening titles to the Amazing Stories series that I worked on with Spielberg and with Toby, by the way, it shows the telling stories around the campfire morphing into telling stories on a TV. And the whole family is around the TV watching the TV. And that was very much what television was. It was incredibly important. It still is to a certain extent, but now there are so many different platforms through which we attain our media, our entertainment, our news, our culture, that it's not like it was in the 80s when it was more powerful. Now, how old were you when you saw it, Marisa?
I don't actually remember when I watched the film. I think it was one of those things where older siblings of friends, it would be something on in the background, and I'd hear that scary music and take a peek and kind of see some of those iconic images from the film. So I feel like it's something that came to me in bits and pieces over the years.
Right, you never saw it in one fell swoop in one
Right.
sitting. How about you, Frank? How old were you when you saw it?
Yes, I was in my teens when I saw it. I'm a bit older than Marisa. I was born in 1973, so I probably saw it by the late 80s, like 5, 6 years after it was released.
So that's a good time to see it in your teens.
Yes, yeah, it was a perfect moment. And but yes, I mean, I totally agree with her. I mean, it has become so iconic, the image of Carol Ann with her hands on the TV screen, and that really haunted, I think, the 1980s and the 1990s as a very, very powerful image.
Yeah, it was fascinating to have those two movies come out within a week of each other, and both of them become such successes. Obviously, E.T. became the most successful film of all time, but Poltergeist was hugely successful as well. And both of them to come from producer slash director Steven Spielberg, what an amazing 1-2 punch. And everybody who saw them in their youth, remember them in their adulthood, and they still maintain that power. And that's the power that Steven Spielberg often brought with his projects, is once seen, never forgotten.
I would possibly add another film to that list, and that is The Shining. And I know that you have shot a version of The Shining, and I think that there are a lot of similarities between Poltergeist and The Shining, with a very central child at the heart of the story, and the house, the hotel, that are haunted places that are of the utmost importance, and which are somehow built according, I would say, to on a non-Euclidean geometry of sorts. I mean, it doesn't always make sense how things are connected in those places.
No, that's a very good point because children at the heart of a story, they're supposed to be protected. And to have children in situations where it's impossible to protect them, the guilt of parenthood, particularly Jack Torrance, in a drunken rage, he breaks his little boy's arm. And the potency of that and the guilt that's already on his back, and now he's got to protect him against supernatural forces. And it's the same thing with Craig T. Nelson in Poltergeist. The necessity, the requirement of parenthood is that you take care of your children because they can't take care of themselves. And when it comes to the supernatural, that's beyond the powers of most mortal human beings to be able to fulfill. And I think that's one of the reasons these movies were both really popular with young people. When The Shining came out, the reviews were terrible, but those were adults. But people, even though it was an R-rated movie, kids got to see it and they really embraced it and they identified with little Danny Torrance.
And once again, it's another Stephen King story. So I think that Stephen King really was instrumental in all this focus on children and their personal stories at that moment in time, wasn't he?
I definitely think so. I mean, you read the story of The Body that became the movie Stand By Me, and Graveyard Shift is filled with stories with young people, and the movie certainly is. And Sleepwalkers was teenagers, but King really knows how to write characters. He can write women in the first person. He can write kids in the first person. He's such a talented writer and so gifted in slipping into other people's minds and bodies that his influence is still felt like that. Even though most of his work these days is very much about adults, I don't think he'll ever lose that ability to take on other personalities, unlike his own. Well, his Holly books are all in the first person of a female, or at least the perspective of a female, and he's so good at it.
And speaking of sensitivities in terms of family and the role of children, what do you recall from your time on set? What can you tell us perhaps about Hooper's directing style and how he worked with the excellent cast of Poltergeist?
Well, he was really good with kids. And I didn't see that much of the interaction. One thing you learn about making movies is how much filmmaking takes place off the set. All of the preparation, the conversations with the actors and the like. But especially with kids, there's certainly more interaction on the set. And I didn't see a whole lot of that, but what I saw of it was very sensitive, He was really good with kids. He didn't. Well, he has a son, Tony, who he brought up. But so he certainly can identify with the childhood thought processes. But I must admit, I did not see a whole lot of interaction between them.
But it's interesting that he was good with children, because when I think about the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I mean, this is not the first thing that comes to my mind, having a good relationship with children. So it's very interesting to know that. And I was really wondering about that, about the ability of someone who had shot the Texas Chainsaw Massacre to direct a movie where children are such a central part of the story.
Well, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre was so difficult to make. And I think Toby, if he were here today, would be the first one to say that he probably was not very nice to his crew. You know, it was brutalized. The temperatures were into the hundreds. It was really nasty. The locations were next to impossible. And everything they did was difficult to do. Inside the locations was hot and smelly, and all these animal corpses and the stink of that, and everyone was covered with sweat and grime, and it was not an easy movie to make. But here you're in a nice big air-conditioned studio. Your hours are controlled, even though your hours are long on any movie. If you're working on a union film on a studio lot, it's a lot more comfortable. You have more people covering more responsibilities. You have school for the kids every so many hours. They can work so long before they have to go into the schoolroom and do their work. So they're very protected, and everybody is protected. There are safety regulations. Before every day's work, the first assistant director gathers the crew on the set and gives a safety meeting. So it's completely different circumstances. And Toby was a teddy bear. When I met Toby in 1982, he couldn't have been sweeter or more kind. And I know that the people from the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre had a lot of trouble because it was so difficult. But everyone who worked with him on the second Texas Chainsaw Massacre loves him. So it's an interesting maturation of an artist. Somebody who had to be rough with the people in order to make the masterpiece that he made, and became a guy who didn't have to work that hard. I mean, he worked that hard, but under much more pleasant conditions.
And in terms of your time on set, well, I should say you mentioned that you like to revisit the film whenever it's on. I'm just curious, how does your experience of watching the film Poltergeist today, are there things that you notice that maybe you didn't notice when you were first visiting the set and you say, oh, this is really amazing? Or does it confirm things that you had observed while you were there? I'm just curious to see how your relationship with the film evolved over time.
What's interesting about Poltergeist is, even though I was there and saw outside of the frame, when I'm watching the movie, I get so engaged in it that I don't think about that part. And that's the dream. As a filmmaker, you want people to not think about what's outside the frame. You know, one of the things I watched was them setting up all of the corpses in the swimming pool and the mud coming out of that. And it's so. If you allow yourself to think about that, all you can think about is how slow and tedious, and one shot, and then another shot, and then another shot. And second unit is handling most of that. And when it comes time to bring in the actors, then Toby's there. But the tedium of making a genre film because of all of the moving parts, making a drama, making a comedy is completely different because there's not a lot of mechanics involved. Making a horror movie, there are different tools that you have to put into play. Plus, this had a lot of effects, visual effects as well as practical effects, long before there were computer-generated effects. And so when I watch the movie, it's so beautifully crafted that I don't think about how it was made, even though I happen to be there. When there's a scene on that I was at when they were shooting it, I'll remember that, but it won't take me out of it.
Yeah, best sign of success ever for a film.
Yeah. One thing I really remember, though, is every time we see everything being sucked into the closet, I remember the technician showing me how they did that. And, you know, it's a big room on a gimbal. So it turns. The camera stays locked to the floor and the room is tilted up. So everything falls toward the camera and the closet. And it's a big, expensive way to do something very effectively without any visual effects involved at all. And it worked great. You got to maintain your balance if you're an actor in that room, though.
But this closet is very interesting for the story itself. It really is the center of the haunting. It is like recently we discussed, I don't know if you're familiar with the British TV program Ghost Watch.
Oh, I love it. Yes, Stephen Volk, who wrote it, is a friend of mine.
Yeah, we've had him several times on the podcast. He's also a regular of this podcast, and we were discussing the fact that under the staircase there is that place which is something akin to the closet in Poltergeist, which is also the center of the haunting, something like a black hole that is sucking everything inside itself.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have any thoughts about the closet, about its role in the story, about how it relates to the little girl and to the family?
Well, I'm not sure what the intent is because in Poltergeist, more so than in Ghost Watch, it kind of gives up the story just to make some scary scenes, whether they make sense or not. And, there are some things in Poltergeist where you go, I don't know if this is actually logical or what are these monsters with the giant legs and all that? I'm not sure what that is. So I think there are times when it lets go of the storytelling logic just to create something that's visceral and scary. And if it works, it works. And it does. You know, it you are definitely willing to suspend your disbelief because it's such a captivating movie.
And gosh, those lighting effects in the closet, I still marvel at those and the techniques involved. I mean, I don't have the knowledge to really dissect specifically how things were done, but just in terms of visual impact, for me, that scene is incredible.
Oh, it's just great. They really shot it beautifully. You know, everybody's input from the director of photography to Steven Spielberg to Tobe Hooper. I mean, they were all on the same page. They were all making the same movie. And, all of them contributed to it. And Tobe was the guy who wore the hat, you know, although Steven always wore hats too. So caps, yeah.
And have you seen Poltergeist 2 and 3 as well?
I have seen them, but only when they came out, and I haven't seen them since. They just don't seem like they were made by the same people because they weren't. I mean, Victor and Grace, of course, did write Poltergeist 2, but it doesn't feel like a Spielberg or a Hooper movie. What, have you seen it?
No, we've seen the two of them. It's true that they feel very different. Each one has a specific mood. I think they are interesting also for various reasons, but they don't have the same impact as the one directed by Tobe Hooper for sure.
The third one is really going out on a limb. That definitely.
It's true. It's true.
At least the second one builds a bit on the mythology. I think it had a mood, so I was okay with the second one, but by the third one, I was really feeling like, oh yeah, okay, excuse for the fact that the actors who played the parents didn't want to come back and everybody's kind of dispersing left and right.
Well, it's interesting. That was the last, Poltergeist was the last Spielberg production that he was not an owner of. And so MGM owned it and they controlled the sequel rights. And so Spielberg was not involved. Whereas with E.T., that was the first one that Amblin Entertainment owned it. So, Universal had some ownership rights as well. But Spielberg controlled that and everything to come afterwards. So whatever sequels were made, he had no control over the sequels to Jaws. He had no control over the sequels to Poltergeist, or if there were to be a 1941 sequel, which was also highly unlikely. But Poltergeist, and he made a point of it, he told me that was the last one that I can't control what happens afterwards. That he was actually a producer for hire on that one.
Would you say that this is your favorite film of Tobe Hooper, or is there another one in his filmography that you would rank above Poltergeist?
My favorite Tobe Hooper film is Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. Yeah, which is a very eccentric choice, but I just love how funny it is and how uncensored it is and how crazy it is. And I remember telling Toby, you know, out of all your movies, and I love them all, I think my favorite is Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. And he said, you know, Mick, I agree with you.
No, in a sense, it's very similar to Gremlins 2. That is
Yes, bigger and better.
taking the mythology and totally turning it around and playing with it like with a toy.
Absolutely. And Gremlins 2 is so much bigger than the first Gremlins and so much more ambitious because he was allowed to be. But Chainsaw Massacre 2 was not successful. It was not well received. I'm not sure what the reviews were like, but I loved it from the first time I saw it. It was so extreme in its humor. You know, people talk about black humor, and I always use the term red humor for this one because it's so fucking bloody. It's just so filled with gore and hilariousness, you know. How something that gory can be that funny is shocking to me. But it's also visually arresting. And the performances and Caroline Williams and Bill Moseley and everybody in it and Dennis Hopper, it's so crazy. And Kit Carson's script is, you know, completely nuts. And he'd never written a genre film before. Obviously, the hand of Tobe Hooper is very, very well felt on this material.
Well, this makes me feel like watching it again.
Yeah, you should. You should. There's a lot of screaming in it, so if you've got the volume up high, put the kids to bed.
If Poltergeist was shot today, do you think it would function as well as in the 1980s? Do you think that, well, what would need to be changed perhaps to function in our days? I've got the feeling that television is not exactly what it used to be in the 1980s. Do you think
Yeah,
the script would
you
have
know,
adapted?
I'm not big on revisiting movies and remaking them because if somebody, well, this was remade in what, 2015 or so, and I never saw the remake because I heard not very good things about it, and the original has such a big place in my heart. But today, you know, it would be made with CG effects and even, I mean, the best CG effects, you can't even tell they're CG. But most CG effects feel like video games. They don't have the weight of reality. They don't, you know, latex may look like rubber sometimes, but sometimes it looks perfect. And actors are acting against it and with it and interacting with it in ways that when they're dealing with CG monsters, it's basically a green tennis ball on a mic stand, you know, that okay, imagine this is a big scary monster. And you're right, media is so scattered, but I think you could still tell a great story set in suburban America, a great ghost story in which these creatures of our guilty past are released upon a family. I think you could still do that, and people are still trying to do it these days. But don't make it Poltergeist. You know? Poltergeist is Poltergeist and should be left on its own because it still works great today with an audience. If it were re-released today, I'll bet that it could get a great audience and they'd love it.
Totally agree.
What do you think about the relationship between stories of true hauntings or horrific events and those kind of inspiring certain film adaptations? I'm especially thinking about the 1980s because I remember it as a time when I was living in the US that there were so many kind of expose style programs on television of like hauntings and unsolved mysteries, and those were really intriguing as a kid, but they were pretty questionable in terms of, how truthful those might or might not be. And I'm just wondering what you think about that transposition to adapting stories like that for the screen.
All those shows seemed to be kind of tawdry and exploitive, and I didn't believe them very much.
Yeah.
If a good story is being told, I don't care if it's a true story or not. If it is, like the Amityville Horror is supposedly based on a true story, I don't know. I don't know about Geordie the pig and all the flies and all of that stuff. I'm not so sure that it worked the way that it works in the movie. Or movies. There've been like eight of them, I think. But if a story is well told and with engaging characters that I identify with, and it takes me places I don't expect to go, I'm with it. I don't care if it's a true story or a non-true story, because even if it says it's a true story, it probably isn't.
Which goes along with what you were saying about CGIs. I mean, it is the artificiality of storytelling that is really important, and you don't really need these to be necessarily close to reality to function or not. It's the ability to be a good storyteller that matters.
Right. And CG has gotten to the point where it's an excellent tool that can allow you to do things that you couldn't do before. I mean, you can make a big practical monster, but you can have it blink its eyes in a realistic way, or have the pupils dilate, or have the mouth salivate in ways that you couldn't do before practically. So the marriage of practical effects and computer-generated effects is a beautiful one. And I've used CGI early on. One of the first CG movies was Sleepwalkers, and there are ways that it was cumbersome and maybe don't doesn't look as good as 30 years later that the technique looks now. But it can allow you to do things you couldn't do before, and there are CG movies or effects in movies that are done CG that you cannot tell are CG. And it's just another tool in the filmmaker's toolbox. And it's an important one. A lot of people say, ah, CG, I hate it. Well, if it's used right, you don't hate it because you don't even know that's what you're seeing.
That's right. Oh. This is a side tangent, but we recently rewatched Sleepwalkers, which is such a great film. And I
Oh,
had a
thanks.
realization while watching the film that I think Buffy the Vampire Slayer copied a bit of those effects for the transformations. Do you know anything about that?
Maybe they did, but I've never seen Buffy the Vampire Slayer. So, if so, I'm very humbled and complimented by it.
Yes. No, I think there was definitely a source of inspiration there in terms of the transformation with the humans to vampires when they shift.
Excellent. Now I'll have to watch.
Are you currently working on something?
Yeah, I've got a few things going. I have a spec script that is going around town now, a feature script, and I've also written a pilot based on a Stephen King story that we've just set up at a network, and we'll see. I mean, right now it's in the business people's hands, so if it gets made, you'll hear about it. If it doesn't get made, you won't. But it'll be great to do work with Stephen King again if that works out, because there's nobody more fun to work with than Stephen King.
And you are such an icon of horror. You have given so much to the genre. But I'm just trying to think back to 1982, you working as a publicist. What would you say being involved on the set of Poltergeist, what did that give to you as a young professional, and how did it shape any aspect of your trajectory to come?
Well, it gave me a window I would never have had otherwise. I worked on a lot of movies and did making of documentaries that allowed me to see behind the curtain of The Wizard of Oz, and see the nuts and bolts, see how long and tedious the work is to do something that flies by in an hour and a half when you're watching it. But in this particular case, being able to be on the set of a very controversial movie about how it was made, and to actually see Tobe Hooper in action and Steven Spielberg in action. And by the way, when in that face in the mirror, when he's ripping his face off, those are Steven Spielberg's hands doing that. And so watching that, I mean, things like that, it just allowed me to see something that became history. Not everything. I mean, I've been lucky enough to be around a lot of very important movies and be that little Forrest Gump in the back corner of the picture, the Zelig of horror, as I like to say, the unimportant guy that's out of focus in the back of the picture of the very famous people doing what they're doing. And just knowing that I've been able to look through a very special private window is something I appreciate every day. I mean, I'm grateful every day for the professional and the personal life that I've been allowed to live.
And talking about very important movies, I don't know if you can see Marissa's t-shirt, but she has always been a big fan of this film. And when I told her that you were coming on the podcast, she was jumping up and
Oh, what's Hocus Pocus? What's that about? I think there's some witches in it or something.
down. It's a defining film for my generation.
It's kind of amazing how females, and not just your generation, but even 6-year-olds today, you go out on Halloween and there's little girls dressed as the Sanderson sisters. And to have been a part of something that has become iconic around the world is humbling, and yet, it's exciting, it's thrilling. Not many people get to make creations that everybody knows about, and not just knows about, but loves. And that's something that, I made a joke at a convention. David Kirshner, who came up with the original idea as a story he told his children, a bedtime story. He was the producer of Hocus Pocus. And so I was the first writer of 12 writers on the project. And we were at a convention, and there was a crowd of 1,500 people in the audience. And backstage, I had told David a joke. I said, "Now, I'm very happily married, but I'm for the joke's purpose," I said, "if I could get lucky tonight, if I wore a t-shirt saying I wrote Hocus Pocus." And so we're in front of this crowd of 1,500 people. And David said, "Mick, tell them what you told me earlier." And I said, No, don't make." And I ended up having to tell it to 1,500 people who all cheered because I think they were 90% female. So.
I can believe it.
But this is not the only, by far, defining moment in cultural history to which you've contributed. I mean, you also were at the root of Masters of Horror. Can you tell us a little bit about Masters of Horror?
Yeah, it started out, a lot of the people who direct horror films meet each other at film festivals, at Directors Guild meetings, things like that, which was the case. And often we would say, we ought to put together a dinner one of these days. And so that went on for a couple of years. And it was like, nobody's going to do this, these lazy fucking directors. So I thought, I'm going to do it. And I spent a week putting together a dozen people. It was Wes Craven and Tobe Hooper and John Landis and Guillermo del Toro and John Carpenter and Tobe Hooper. There were a dozen of us, Bill Malone. And at that dinner, everybody had such a great time that the next one took an hour for me to organize. And so at those dinners, one of the many things we would talk about was being in control of our own destinies. You know, Toby and Carpenter and most of them had been abused by the studio system and even the independent world. And wouldn't it be great to be able to do things on our own? And so I came up with the concept of here's an hour-long weekly series, little movies, hour-long movies made by the greatest people in the genre. And we pitched it to three places, and the pitch was you can have these guys, but you can't get in their way. So, you know, you can give notes, but they may well ignore them and probably will. And give them, there's not a lot of time, not a lot of money, but complete creative freedom, which nobody gives you. And so we pitched it to three companies. Anchor Bay was the first one. They said, how much and when can we start? And we were off running that day. And even though it ran on Showtime, it would have been made even without that, because, but Anchor Bay took it to Showtime, who were not looking for any series. And they saw the value of it and said, yeah, we would love that. Their financial commitment was very small. It was 10% an episode. So we told them, you're not paying enough to have any control over this. We're making it, you're just licensing it. And we were able to give the keys of the kingdom to the keys to the asylum to the inmates. Everybody was able to do it. And so we were able to give some great filmmakers an opportunity to be unfettered in their creative endeavors, fettered only by time and money. So, but these guys have great imaginations that allowed them to do really high quality work at a very low budget, which almost all of them had done before they were doing studio movies. So it was one of the proudest moments of my career was that I was able to bring all these. I produced movies by John Carpenter and Toby Hooper and Takashi Miike and Stuart Gordon and all of these wonderful. Yeah, Dario Argento. Yeah.
Yeah, it was such a great gift to the horror community. I can remember when we were waiting for new episodes and every week getting so excited to see who would be the next director involved in the project. It was just an incredible gift that keeps on giving because we have the physical media now
That makes me so happy. It was such a glorious experiment that really worked out great.
And what is your relationship with television, globally speaking, in relationship to cinema? Do you direct films differently, apart from the constraints from the studio, or?
Well, these days, there are so many big screens in people's homes. I have an 86-inch television in my home. You've got surround sound at home. And even when I was doing television for a 4x3 screen, doing The Stand and doing The Shining and doing things like that, I didn't watch series television very much. I loved movies. And I didn't think you had to do close-ups and master shots to make a movie for television. So The Stand, if you look at it, and you know, for the first time last year, I saw it on the big screen for its 30th anniversary. Paramount made up a DCP and the American Cinematheque showed it on the big screen in 4x3, but on the big screen. And it was like, wow, this really looks like a movie. I guess this worked the way I intended it to. And I think people watch movies on television. So what's the difference? So I don't think there's a different way other than back in the day when we were making movies for television that had commercial breaks, you would have to figure out where your act would end and how to start the next act without deflating the energy of the project. So that was a big issue when King was writing The Stand and we were planning how it would be structured. But I think the filmmaking process is the filmmaking process, and there need not be any difference between making television and making movies. And now people watch them all on their phones anyway. So.
It's true. But what is it that David Lynch once advised? He said, "Get off your fucking phone. Don't watch the film on your phone."
Yeah, good for him. And then David Cronenberg embraces it. He says, "Yeah, I'm watching Lawrence of Arabia on my Apple Watch right now." So
Wow.
Different approaches.
exactly. Different strokes for different folks.
Well, maybe to just come back to Poltergeist briefly, could you let us know why you think it has had such a lasting legacy? Why are people still watching and talking about Poltergeist today?
Because it's scary, because everything about it works, because it still feels contemporary, even though there are no cell phones or computers, and because it's set in a universally recognizable neighborhood. I think these are people, they're blue-collar people who are confronted in their homes with something terrifying. And I think that is universal, and I think it's something that will always last. I mean, here it is, 42 years later, and we're talking about it on a podcast, a medium that did not exist 42 years ago. So that speaks to the power of the movie.
I think it's very interesting what you're saying about the fact that they are threatened in their home. Because, I mean, there have been a lot of films that are about the danger coming from outside, but here the danger is inside the house itself.
There's no safe place to run to. It's a terror from within. Your
Yes.
home is supposed to be your safe place, and it's not. It turns out to be the place you have to leave and stay in a motel, you know?
Great. And we usually like to end by asking our guests, is there something we should have asked or something you wish we would have asked you about the film that you've chosen? Is there anything you'd like to add about Poltergeist?
No, just one thing I would like to say is that it's great to have the opportunity to defend Toby because so many people want to give all the credit. You know, Spielberg deserves a lot of credit on this movie, but so does Toby Hooper. And Toby Hooper was the director, and Steven Spielberg was the very influential writer producer. And I think they need to be given equal credit. And Toby did the job that a studio director in the 1940s or the 1950s would have been assigned and would have done. And he did it great, and he brought a lot of ideas and imagination into it. There's a lot of Toby Hooper in this movie, as much as there is Steven Spielberg. And I just always love the opportunity to be able to share that. Because I loved Toby. He was a really good friend, and his passing hit us all hard, but it really broke my heart.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Mick Garris, and thank you for honoring his legacy today with us. It's been such a pleasure discussing Poltergeist.
Thank you, Frank and Marisa.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images Podcast on social media.